Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, five lines down. Am Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Yitomim ain't tzrichim pruzbol. Yitomim do not require a pruzbol. V'chein Tani Rami Bar Chama, we have a bright that supports that understanding, that Yitomim ain't tzrichim pruzbol. Yitomim do not need pruzbol. The Rabbi Gamliel u'beit dino, avihen sho yitomim. Because Rabbi Gamliel and his Beit Din are like the fathers of the Yitomim. Now, as Rashi points out over here, Rabbi Gamliel Beit Dino is not just uniquely Rabbi Gamliel Beit Dino. It's the fact that this Tano, we're bringing a Braita down, was contemporary with Rabbi Gamliel Beit Dino. So he lists Rabbi Gamliel as the Beit Din of his time, but not to indicate Rabbi Gamliel and no one else, but is it true of any Beit Din? It is a theory of law that applies today. They use it in many countries. The United States uses it of parents patriae, which is that the court is ultimately responsible to its citizens, or in a sense that it's responsible for the best interests of its citizens, and especially with regards to yitomim or children, that the court sees themselves as the ultimate parent or guardian of the yitomim. So similarly over here, Rabbi Gamliel Beit Dino is avihen shel yitomim. They are the fathers of the yitomim, and that ultimately they are the last stop in terms of being the parents or the guardians of the yitomim. And in doing so, it's automatic that the outstanding loans of the yitomim are therefore under the auspices of Beit Din, or ke'ilo, they are misurim the Beit Din. And that is that, for sure, like Rashi says over here, when we're talking about the outstanding loans of their father, and if the father extended credit, and they inherited those loans, and people have to repay them, that they are automatically assumed to be have given over to Beit Din because of this Avihen Shel Yitomim. But there are other Rishonim who suggest that it goes beyond that, that even loans that they make now with the monies of the estate will also be governed by the Beit Din, because again of this thesis that the Beit Din is the Avihen Shel Yitomim, and therefore they don't have to actively give over their loans to Beit Din. It's as if it is automatically that their loans are given over to Beit Din, because Beit Din will always intercede on their behalf to protect them, whether that's because they have a court-appointed executor to the estate, which means that he's acting on behalf of the Beit Din, or even without that, the Beit Din will intervene on their behalf of their interests, and therefore they are always as if the Beit Din is holding a portion of their credit that they are extending. And for that reason, they don't need a pruzbol, because they are as if they are acting within the auspices of the, as proxies of the Beit Din, and therefore they don't need a pruzbol for the loans that are outstanding. Now, the next qualification here is tznan hotam. We have a Mishnah in Shvi'it that says, in kodvim pruzbol, el ala karka. You only write a pruzbol if the borrower has land. Imein lo, if he does not have land, mizakeu betoch sadeu koshu, then the lender gives him rights to a piece of land in the middle of his field. Bekama koshu, what does that mean? Any amount, right? That's a strange question. A koshu usually means a koshu, which means any amount. So the fact that the Gemara asked the question leads some Rishonim to believe that there is a minimum amount, which is going to be listed here. Other Rishonim just say these are examples, and he's still, a koshu is a koshu, and any amount of land would suffice. Rav Chiya Barashi, Amarav, afilu kelach shel kruv. Even a stalk of cabbage is sufficient ground or karka. Amar Rav Yehuda afilu hishilo makom letanur v'kirayim. Even if he lends him space to put down his stove or his oven, that's enough that you can be kotvin alav pruzbol, that you can write a pruzbol on that land. Ini, is that really true? V'atani Hillel. Didn't Hillel bring down? Now Rashi claims over here that this is not the Tana Hillel that we know, but rather this is the Amora Hillel, likely because of the language that the Gemara uses here, Tani, and then usually it fills in an Amora. That means that an Amora is bringing a Braita down. So if you say about Tani Hillel, it implies that Hillel is bringing a Braita. That would not be said about Hillel Hazakein, Hillel the Tano. So rather it must be Hillel the Amora. And that's what Rashi concludes here, that this is Hillel the Amora. Ein kotvim pruzbol, el ala tzitz nakuv bilvad. That you only learn to write a pruzbol on a tzitz, a planter that has a hole in it. Nakuvin, that's only if it has a hole in it. Shein nakuv lo. But if it does not have a hole, no. That's despite the fact that amai vayika mekomo. Just as you said before that the place where you place down the object is sufficient ground to be considered karka that you can write the prusbol on. But you put your stove in your oven, that karka is sufficient to have the prusbol written on that karka. So over here, even if you have a planter that has no hole in it and it's not mechuber the karka, but if you place it down somewhere, then that should be enough land to write the prusbol on. Lo, tzricha, the manach hasichi, that it's placed up on pegs. It's not sitting on the ground. It's sitting elevated off the ground on some sort of pegs. And even though the pegs themselves are sitting in the ground, either we have to say that there's not sufficient ground that is covered by the pegs, or that they're just too thin to make a difference, and therefore it's not considered as if they have karka here. Ravashi maknele gidma de dikla v'katavale prusbol. Ravashi used to be makne a tree stump, and then he'd write a prusbol based on that. Now, the fundamental question here is, why do you need karka in order to have a prusbol? Right, we understand the need for a prusbol. Now, we want to understand why the takana only applies to a borrower that has karka. So Rashi claims over here that the Chachamim would only institute a takana in a place where it's shchiach, where it's a common type of transaction. And that's what Rashi says over here. Lo tikkinu ela bizman shachov kishar rov shtarot shehin nigavim min hakarka. Davi milta d'shchicha. All that the karka does is creates a standardization that this is a normal loan. And the Chachamim would only institute prusbol in cases where it's a normal loan. What's the definition of a normal loan? That's a loan that is given with karka as the collateral, where the person has some way to collect from this individual. And again, in their day, the most secure type of collateral was land. And therefore, Rashi says that because of that, the Chachamim instituted prusbol only works when the borrower has land, because that's a standard type of loan. When you don't have land on the other side, that's already a non-standard loan, because people don't generally lend to someone who doesn't have collateral, or doesn't have an ability to pay them back the money, at least through the collateral. Even though you have a number of items here. One is that it's not shaveh l'kol achov. Even though now the karka that you're giving is not at the equal value to the entirety of the loan that is given. And even though in this case, like for instance with the atzitz nakuf, or items that are given that they are not really karka in the true sense of karka, meaning that as Tosfot points out, the reason that karka is so important is because it doesn't walk away. Karka is always there. The reason that people secure their loans with karka is because they know where they can go collect it from. If you secure your loan with metaltalim, metaltalim walk. Metaltalim can be moved, can be transacted, can be sold. And therefore that's not real security. So karka is important in security for the one reason, which is it doesn't move. And number two is that's the normal type of encumbrance that's done in a loan. So then Rashi says, despite the fact that in our case here, when he has a small parcel of a land, it does not equal the loan. And number two is we're even giving examples of items that can walk, which is you have a planter that has a hole in it. Even though it's considered like karka, that can be picked up and taken away. Despite those two things, that is still within the rubric of this standard takana of prusbol. So Chachamim, as Rashi says, like lo plug, they didn't make a any differentiation. As long as you have karka, then we allow the institution of prusbol to go through. Now, Rashi then contends that even though the karka is not worth the value of the loan, it still solves our problem because, in general, when it comes to karka, one can collect the loan in the end. And that's based on what we saw earlier in the Gemara, Katina de Abaye. Katina de Abaye is an incident where the individual was a creditor against the Yitomim, and he had a loan outstanding, say, for 100, and the land that the Yitomim were holding was only worth 50. So he took the land in lieu of payment for his loan. The Yitomim came and then offered him money to buy back the land. He took the money that they paid him, and they got the land back. As soon as they had the land back, he took it again, because they hadn't fulfilled all the obligation of the loan. And so then he had the other half of his loan repaid, because he took the karka. So this is a way that even with a small parcel of land, one could end up collecting their loan. That's what Rashi says, Tosafot reinforces that idea, that even with a small parcel of land, you can keep taking the piece of land. Every time the individual pays you back for the land to take it back, then you take the land again, and you're able to collect your loan even with a small parcel of land. So that's how they deal with the issue of the inequality between the size of the land and the obligation, that doesn't matter because, in a sense, any piece of land or any size of land can be used to recapture the credit that was extended. Then Tosafot brings an alternative view from the Rashbam, which is that karka does not have ona'ah. Ona'ah is a term that the Torah uses to describe the overcharging or undercharging for the purchase of an object. So the Rishonim argue about the fact as to whether karka has ona'ah. It's clear that karka doesn't have ona'ah. The question is, to what extent does karka not have ona'ah? Rashi is of the belief that karka has no ona'ah whatsoever. There is no price for land, because land has different values in different people's eyes. There's no inherent value to land, because location, location, location. That means that different people will assess a different value to a same parcel of land, and therefore there is no ona'ah by land whatsoever. And so therefore, the Rashbam over here claims that's the reason that any or a small amount of land can be used to write the principal on, even though the loan is significantly greater, because land's value could equal the loan, even though it's a small parcel of land. It all depends on who's buying it, where it is. And so therefore, we do not worry about the fact that there's some sort of inequality between the size of the land and the loan that is outstanding. Tosafot rejects it, l'shitato, because Tosafot believes that there is ona'ah b'karka, it's just limited to 50%. He says that 50% is the number. If the overcharging or undercharging exceed 50% of the value of the land, then that's already called ona'ah b'karka. So Tosafot has a limit to how much the karka can be worth vis-a-vis what would be the market value of the karka, and therefore Tosafot does not see that as a valid answer. I would suggest that the reason that karka here is important, not because, like Rashi suggests over here, that you have the ability to collect from it, or you have a standardization that this is a normal type of loan. And I like the Rashbam that it's about value, but simply what we're going to see in the upcoming Gemara, that it is as if collected. When you have land as collateral, when you have something that acts as collateral for the loan, then we don't look at it as being that you have to go out and collect the loan, because you have collateral. And when you have collateral, we look at it as if it's gavoy, as if it is already collected. And because of that, it's that nishmat b'shvi'it. There's no shmita tashvi'it because you have karka. So the idea of writing the prusbol on the karka is effectively to establish that the loan is no longer really like an outstanding loan, but rather it's a loan by which we've already made partial collection on, or we have an ability to collect on. And that land is what gives you that ability. And for that reason, we write a prusbol on the karka, because the prusbol can then use the karka as the vehicle for saying that it's as if collected. I think you're right, which we're going to see in the Gemara in a second, which that if he already has collateral to collect from, then it should be as if collected. You don't need a prusbol at all. The difference between karka and what we're going to see later on in the Gemara, like a mashkon, where you have a physical mashkon collateral in hand, that's the difference, which is choser guvaino. By a mashkon that is already deposited with you, you have to do absolutely nothing to foreclose. By karka, you do have to do something to foreclose on the property. You have to go to Beit Din, you have to do certain things. And because of that, it's not automatic that if you have karka, that it's as if the loan is collected. But having karka, and then having Beit Din with the prusbol be involved, that what allows us to say that Beit Din will act as your collection agent. But when Beit Din acts as the collection agent, having karka, Beit Din can go after the karka and can foreclose for you on the karka. And putting those two pieces together, that's what allows it not to be nishmat on the shvi'it. So I think karka is slightly different than metaltonim. I think that's a fair comment, which we're going to see in the Gemara, that if you have a real mashkon, you don't need a prusbol at all, because then you really, as if collected, and then there's no need for the prusbol. The other thing I want to discuss here is the fact that the Gemara here says that if the borrower does not have karka, that the creditor can give him karka, can be mizakahim karka. We have a principle. You can be mizakeh a person when they're not there, or you can give them ownership if it's to their benefit. But ein chavim l'adam shelo b'fanav. You cannot do something to someone's detriment or to make them an obligation when they're not there. Over here, let's think of this scenario. If the creditor's karka does not transfer over to the debtor, then what will happen when shvita comes? The loan will be forgiven. So it's in the best interest of the borrower over here to have no land. Yet we're saying over here that the creditor can be mizakehim in land. It's not a zchut for him to get the land. If he gets the land, then he writes a prusbol, and then the loan stays outstanding. If he doesn't get him the land, the loan will be forgiven because of Shemitah. Yeah. So what type of zchut is this for him to give him the land? What you have to say here, and in doing so, it might change our view about Zochen Adam Shelo B'fanav, which is that there is a zchut here, but the zchut is on a more holistic level. Which is that, you're right, in this direct transaction, it's to the detriment of the borrower to get the land. And if you look on it very much on a micro level, then you would not have the land transferred from the creditor to the borrower because it's all to his detriment. But if you look at this on a more macro, holistic level, the whole reason for Prisbo is to open up the liquidity in the loan market. If we don't allow this to go through, I mean, we don't allow the creditor to grant land to the borrower, then what's going to happen is they're going to shut down the loan market again, which is that nobody's going to lend to anybody who doesn't have land because they'll have no way to recover this when Shemitah comes. And so then you're back to square one. It will defeat the purpose of the takana, which is to open up the liquidity in the loan market. So in looking at a zchut here, we don't look at this micro transaction and say it's to his detriment to get the land. We look at it on a broader level and say that if we don't have him get the land here, then we're going to shut down the whole loan market. And that's considered to be enough of a zchut that the creditor can grant property to the borrower. And zachut shadam shelo b'fanav, even though, again, on a very, very micro level, it's not the zchuto, but on a macro or holistic level, it is the zchuto. And that might open up the possibility that when you look at a zchut for a person, when you're granting them ownership in something, we don't necessarily look in a just finite, very parochial way at this particular transaction or this particular item, but we have to look on a broader perspective as to whether this is really a beneficial item or not a beneficial item, and that's what must be happening over here. Otherwise, there's no way you could be mizaka someone in land that works to their detriment. The next Gemara is Rabbonon Debei Rav Ashi Masri Milayu Lehadodi. They used to give over their loans to each other. Rabbi Yonatan Masar Milay Rabbi Chir Babo. Rabbi Yonatan gave over his loans to Rabbi Chir Babo. Amalei Tzrichna Mide Achrino. Do I need anything more? Amalei Lo Tzrich. You don't need anything more. That's it. That's sufficient. So over here, we see them giving over their loans to each other. The nature of what is happening here is not clear. Rashi says over here, Belok Tivat Puzbol. They didn't even write a Puzbol, but they gave over to each other their loans. The reason seems to be because they are Chavirim. They were already Chavrei Beitin. And therefore, they were handing it over to each other because it was the equivalent of giving it over to Beitin because of the stature of these individuals, and therefore they did it in a way which didn't require them to do a formal prusbol and giving it up because they basically sat in the court, or they were the court, and therefore they could hand over their loans to each other. Now what's interesting here is the Tosafot read over here says, Afagav de Ravashi hava b'Bavel. Ravashi is in Bavel, and we have over here Ravashi, and we also have the Rabbonon de Bei Ravashi. Both of them are speaking in this Gemara. And even though they're found in Bavel, ve'ein shvi'it noheged b'chutz la'aretz. There's no shvi'it in chutz la'aretz. V'afil mide rabbanan. So then, what's going on over here that we have Rav Ashi and the Tana d'Bei Rav Ashi doing all of this? Afilu hachi, hashmatat ksafim noheged, shi'i chuvat aguf. Shmitat ksafim is a chuvat aguf, not talui ba'aretz, not a mitzvah talui ba'aretz, and therefore, it should be carried out in Bavel. Delo svirle kerabi. They don't hold like Rabbi, the Mekish Hashmatat Ksafim, Lashmatat Karkot. If you remember yesterday, Rabbi says there's a correlation between Shmitat Ksafim and Shmitat Karkot. When there's no Shmitat Karkot, there is no Shmitat Ksafim. So now, Ravashi and the Rabbonin de Bei Ravashi live in Chutz Laretz, where there is no Shvi'it. And therefore, if you really correlated the two, it would seem like there should be no Shemitah Ksafim for them because they don't have Shemitah Karka. Now, the Tosfah Reed makes a number of assumptions here. Number one is that Rabbi's statement means that if there is no Shemitah, there is no Shemitah Ksafim, means that anywhere there's no Shemitah, there is no Shemitah Ksafim. You don't necessarily have to read Rabbi's statement that way. You could just read, when there is Shemitah Karka in Eretz Yisrael, there's Shemitah Ksafim everywhere. You don't have to read it. Here he's reading it is that when there's no Shemitah Ksafim where you live, Shemitah Karka where you live, there is no Shemitah Ksafim according to Rabbi. You don't have to read it that way, but he does. Which again was what we discussed yesterday, why some of this Prusbol, or the issue of Prusbol, fell by the wayside in many of these countries. The Rishonim discussed this issue of saying that there's no din of Shmita Ksafim in Chutz Laaretz. What do you mean there's no din of Shmita Ksafim? It's a Chovat Aguf. So it's like Rabbi. They break this Hekesh, which makes Shmita Ksafim look like Shmitat Karka. And so because of that, they think that it doesn't apply in Chutz Laaretz. And you see the Tosafot read saying that. But he says, nevertheless, they kept it. Why? Kerabonon Svirle, Delo Makshe. They hold like the Rabbonon of Rabbi who don't have the Hekesh between them. Therefore, they think Shmita Ksafim is independent of Shmita Dakarka. And therefore, they did keep Shmita Ksafim despite the fact that there was no Shmita Dakarka in Bavel or where they lived. Again, you could have argued that they could hold like Rabbi, just that Shmita Dakarka means an Eretz Yisrael. And if there's Shmita Dakarka going on in Eretz Yisrael, then there's Shmita Ksafim in Chutz Laaretz. Now, the truth is that that is also true. In the time of Rav Ashi, Shmita Dakarka in Eretz Yisrael was the same as Shmita Dakarka today for us. So whatever the status of Shmita Dakarka is today, whether that's Yovel or Shmita, like we said yesterday, depending on Rashi and Tosafot, if the Rabbanon for us today, it was the Rabbanon for them back then as well. And that means that Shmita Dakarka or Shmita HaYovel was not in practice in the time of Rav Ashi in Eretz Yisrael, Shmidoraita. And if that's the case, then Shmita Ksafim is also not in practice, at least Midoraita, maybe Midorabanan. But still, Tosafot Reed says that Rav Ashi and the Rabbanon debate Rav Ashi only had this practice because they held like the Rabbanon, not like Rabbi. And that's why they were practicing Shmita Ksafim in Chutz Laaretz. Right now, Gemara says, Tan Rabbanan, Ein lo karka, if he does not have land, ul arev yesh lo karka. But the guarantor on the loan has land, kotvin alav prusbol. Then that's sufficient land within this loan to be right at Prusbol. So for Rashi, that means it's a standard loan now, because somewhere in the collateral side of this loan, someone has karka. So it may not be the borrower, but that's why he has a guarantor on the loan, because the borrower didn't have land, so he gets a guarantor with land. Or for the Rashbam, you have a way to get to karka that has no fixed value. Or, like we were saying here, there's a way to have it be as if collected. Lo v'l'arev ein lam karka. Now, what happens if there is no karka for any of the individuals here? The borrower, the guarantor, nobody has land. U'l'chayev lo yesh lo karka. But the one who owes money has karka. Kotevin alav prusbal mib Rabbi Natan. You write a prusbal on this from Rabbi Natan. The scenario here is that you have a borrower, Ruvain. You have a guarantor, Shimon. Neither of which have land. So the lender over here doesn't have anywhere to write a prusbol on because neither Ruvain nor Shimon have land. But it happens to be that the borrower, Ruvain, is owed money by a third party. And that third party is Levi, owes him money, and that third party has land. On that land, you can write the prusbol because of the transitive property of loans, which is known as Rabbi Natan. The Tanya, Rabbi Natan Omer, how do we know that if A borrowed from B and B borrowed from C, how do we know then that you can take from A and give it to C? I mean that you can move directly between the end party and the first party. So there, this is called the transitive property of loans. That you give it to the one who is owed the money, or the one that has the ultimate claim. And so over here, the ultimate claimant is the creditor. And so you have creditor A that lent money to B. B lent money to C. So in the essence, A is a creditor to C. And so the same thing is true here. When he lent money to Reuven and Shimon, the borrower and the guarantor, neither of which have land, but they're owed money by another party, then the creditor is really owed money by that other party. And therefore, that is considered to be karka on which he can write the prusbol. All right, so now, tnan hotam. We have a mishnah in shvi'it again. Ha-shvi'it mishametet et ha-milveh ben bishtar ben shelo bishtar. Shvi'it has the ability to forgive loans, whether the loans were given in a documented form or whether they were oral loans. Rav Shmuel damrei tarvayu. Rav and Shmuel explained it this way. Bishtar, what does it mean, bishtar? Shtar sheyesh bo achrayut nechasim. That's a shtar that has encumbrance or the ability to collect against the property of the individual. Shlo bishtar is shein bo achrayut nechasim. And kol shekein milveh alpeh. So the way that Rav and Shmuel explained that Mishnah and Shvi'it, They say with a shtar, without a shtar is not literally with a document, without a document. It means both loans are documented. It's a question of whether the document allows the person collateral. So if there's achriyut nechasim, which means that he has the ability to go after the property of the individual, or he has an encumbrance on this individual's property, that's a shtar. And without a shtar means, even though you have a document to the loan, just means that you don't have achriyut nechasim. You don't have the ability to go after his property because it's not written into the shtar. And then, of course, an oral loan would, of course, be forgiven. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon Lakish, Damrei Tovayu. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish explained the Mishnah this way. Bishtar, bishtar shein bo achriyut nechasim. When it says a shtar, it means a shtar without the encumbrance. Shelo bishtar means milveh peh, an oral loan. Aval shtar sheish bo achriyut nechasim eino mishamet. So this goes back to what we discussed before, that a shtar that has an encumbrance on that person's property is not subject to shmitah because it's considered as if collected. And this is what I was suggesting before, that might be the reason why you need a karka to write the pruzbol on, is because achrayut nechasim has an impact. And here you see that you have a shtar that grants the creditor rights to the borrower's property, then we view this as if collected or not subject to shmitah, at least according to Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Here you have a machloket Bavel in Eretz Yisrael. In Bavel, Rav and Shmuel believe that it does not matter how the loan is extended, whether it's an oral loan, whether it's a loan with a shtar, whether it's a loan with a shtar that has achrayut nechasim, they are all subject to shmita. On that hand, in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish believe that an oral loan and a loan by shtar are subject to shmita, but a loan through a shtar that has achrayut nechasim has so much power of collection, or the ability to get what they need without having to be what we call egos, without having to pressure the borrower to pay, because the creditor says, you don't want to pay, I'll just take the land, and he doesn't have to pressure the loveh, therefore it's not subject to shmitat ksafim. Tanya kavata de Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. We have a braita that supports this position of Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish. Shtarchov mishamet. A shtarchov, a document of loan, does have shmita. Bim yesh bo achriyut nechasim, eino mishamet. That if it has achriyut nechasim in it, then it's not subject to shmita, which is exactly what Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish said. Tanya yidach. Another braita that seemingly supports them is, Siyem lo sada'achat, b'halvato eino mishamet. If he demarcates the exact property that is collateral for the loan, which we call directed collateral, then there is no shmitah. So the case where it's directed collateral makes a lot of sense, because then what the point of collection or what will be collected is already defined. It's not only that you have an encumbrance on the individual, but he's now giving you the exact property that you're going to collect from if he defaults on the loan. And for that reason, it's as if collected, because basically there's two methods of payment here. Either he's going to pay you cash, or you're going to take this piece of land. You don't even have to go and foreclose or figure out what the land is. He's already demarcated and directed the collateral. Vlod, ela afilu katav kol nechsayai achrayin ba'arvain lach. If he writes that all my property and everything that I own guarantees this loan, or basically is encumbered to this loan. Again, whenever you do this, whenever it talks about achayut nechasim, it's talking about real property here. Enu mishamet. That's not mishamet. And that is similar to what Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish said, that when you have achayut nechasim, that's sufficient to not be subject to shmitah ksafim, and that's what this braita is saying. Not only when you have directed collateral, but even when you have a general lien on the individual's property, that's enough not to be subject to shmitah. Which would then be, by the way, similar to the ktubah. We said before, earlier in the Masechta, that the ktubah is not subject to shmitah ksafim. We said that is because it's really a chov and not a loan. And it's an obligation, but hasn't been turned into a credit situation because you're not demanding payment from it. And from this perspective, you wouldn't even need to say that. You could say that a ktubah has achrayut nechasim in it. The ktubah says that the individual, the husband, encumbers everything that he owns to the obligation of the ktubah. So there's achrayut nechasim that is written into the ktubah, and therefore, according to Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, that would be enough of a reason to say why a ktubah is not subject to shmitat ksafim, is because of that encumbrance or that ability to collect from anything that the chatan or the husband owns. Now, kreve deravasi, havale haushtara, tahavaktiv be achrayut nechasim. So here, a relative of Ravasi had an outstanding loan a loan document. He had extended credit. And in that document had achrayut nechasim. It had a guarantee that the debtor's property was encumbered to the repayment of this loan. Ata the kameder of Asi, amalei mishamet, oena mishamet. So he comes to Rav Asi and says, is this subject to Shemitah or not subject to Shemitah? Amalei enu mishamet. Says, it's not mishamet because of what we saw just before, that Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish believe that when it comes to a document with achrayut nechasim in it, it's not subject to Shemitah. Shavkei, va'ata the kameder Rabbi Yochanan. He leaves Rav Asi and goes to Rabbi Yochanan. It's clear that Rav Asi is saying this based on the shita of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. But here he goes, Rabbi Yochanan, malay mishamet. He says to him, it is mishamet. Ata Rav Asi kameder Rabbi Yochanan. Amalei mishamet, when a mishamet? Amalei mishamet. After his relative went to Rabbi Yochanan and finds out that there it is subject to Shemitah Kesafim, he comes back to Rav Asi and says, listen, Rabbi Yochanan says it is mishamet. So Rav Asi himself goes up to Rabbi Yochanan and says, wait a minute, is it mishamet or not mishamet? So he says, it is mishamet. Aren't you the one who has the opinion that it's not subject to Shemitah Kesafim? What's going on over here? How come you're paskening against your own position? So he says, just because we think that that's the way it should be, we should paskin that way? Now, it's a very interesting usage of it over here. We had this back on Daf Yutet, where Rabbi Yochanan made the same statement. He says, just because we think something is so, you should act on it? Now, over there, it was an extrapolation of a din. We had a din, and then they extrapolated the din to another area of halacha. Over there, Rabbi Yochanan makes this statement, which makes sense. And just because we think that the cases are equal, we think that these two areas of halacha are equal, therefore we should paskin. In that case, you can understand why he would make such a statement, which is, we are using our own intellect here to extend something that is true in one area of halacha to another area of halacha. So we might think that that's the case, but we're not certain enough to paskin like that. Over here, you don't have that. What does that mean, b'chi anu midamim? Just because we think that's the case. Over here, he's stating something that should be halachically evident. He's not extrapolating a din. He's making a statement. And despite that fact, he's saying, even though that's what we believe, I don't want to act on it. And so Rashi quotes and says, "Lo shamanu mirabotenu." This is something that we came on to of our own intellect, not something that we have a masorah about from a rebbeim. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan was unwilling to act on it, because not have a masorah about this issue, but only had thought that that should be the case. And he says, yes, I think the halacha should be this way, but I'm unwilling to paskin based on what I think should be the halacha, because that's all it is. It's me thinking that the halacha should be this way. I don't have a clear masorah about this issue. And therefore he was unwilling, even though he said the halacha is this way, it was difference between halacha in the theoretical sense versus the halacha in the practical sense when you have to act on it. He wasn't willing to act on that. A very interesting usage. It's also very interesting that Rabbi Yochanan says this because we have another place in Shas, his Talmud, Chover, Rabbi Elazar, says one of the things that he says about himself is, takeli, that I never said anything over that I didn't hear from my Rebbeim. That he only said over halacha that he heard from his Rebbeim. The Gemara there challenges him and says, he says over other things that he didn't hear from his Rebbeim. Very interesting, because here you see Rabbi Yochanan himself had that concept, and then Rabbi Elazar, his Talmud Chover, seems to adopt it as well, and also says the same thing, which is that he doesn't say things over. He's not willing to act on halachot that he doesn't have a masorah about from his Rebbeim, which is an important aspect of halacha, which is that when it comes to paskening halacha, and when it comes to understanding, it's not enough to know what's in the Sfarim. It's not enough to know what the halacha is. The Gemara calls it in many places, you need shimush talmidei chachamim. You need a mesorah about how to act in certain cases. When to be mekil, when to be machmir. Mesorah is an important aspect of psak halacha. It's not simply that this is a dry, theoretical type of law where you just look in the books and you make a decision. Because there are influences or there are reasons to be mekil and machmir in different situations. And that's really guided by some sort of mesorah that one has from their Rebbe about how to act or how to answer certain cases and to see things in a certain light. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying over here. There are halachot that may be true, but in order to act on them, you really need a mesorah of piskei halacha in these instances. By the way, this type of idea shows up in the Rabbeinu Tam many times. The Rabbeinu Tam and Tosafot many times will say something, and he believes the halacha is this way, but either the Tosafot will say that he said it, but he wasn't willing to act on it, or the Tosfot will bring that in a real case, Rabbeinu Tam did not paskin that way. So Rabbeinu Tam many times will reach a theoretical position, but yet not act on that position. When someone comes and asks him the shayla, he's unwilling to act on that, even though he thinks the halacha is that way. And it's a strong statement about the intellectual capabilities and abilities of these individuals to reach certain halachic conclusions, but to know their limitations, and to know that even though they might think it should be this way, they don't want to act either because it's against the Mesorah or against the Minhag HaAm, and for that reason, they make a statement and leave it out there. Maybe leave it out there for more discussion, for other Rishonim or others to pick it up, and later on, maybe it will become the halacha, but they themselves are unwilling to act on it until it's vetted in a more in-depth manner. So the Gemara is Amalei. So Rav Asi says back to Rabbi Yochanan, Vatanya Kavadei Demar. Don't you have a braita that supports you? I mean, we brought two braitot that support Rabbi Yochanan. So that should be enough evidence to the fact. Now, so say Rabbi Yochanan says, I don't have a Mesorah. I didn't hear this from my Rebbeim. Okay, that's great. But if you have braitot that support your position, then we know that your concept or your theory exists before. If that's the case, that should be support enough for Rabbi Yochanan to act on his principle. So that's why the Rav Asi is saying to him, listen, you have a braitot that is supporting you. It's not that you're saying this out of the blue. So Dilmahayi Kebet Shemayi. Who says that those braitot really are supportive of me? Maybe the reason those braitot are saying what they're saying is because they hold like Beit Shemayi. Damei Shtar, Homei the Gavot, Ki Gavoi Dami. Something that we saw in Sota, Ketubot, Yivamot, that there's a machloket Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai as to when you have a shtar, when you have a document, whether it's a transaction that has a achriyut nechassim, or whether it's an outstanding credit, a loan that is documented with a achriyut nechassim, how do we view that? Do we view that as if collected, or do we view that you still have to go and collect? Beit Hillel says that it's not as if collected. Beit Shammai says it's as if collected. And there's this impact we saw when multiple parties pass away, and there's safek in the Yerusha, who's considered to be muhzak in parts of the items there. And so Beit Shammai believes that because the contract is considered as if collected, you become the person that's muhzak in that property or muhzak in that item. So Beit Shammai has a position that it's kigavoidam. It's as if done when you have a contract that has achrayut built into it. So he says, maybe those braitot are following the shita of Beit Shammai, or they are Beit Shammai. And the reason why it's not subject to Shemitah Kesafim is because they view the contract as if collected. It's yours already. And that's why. But I pass them like Beit Hillel, and we pass them like Beit Hillel. So maybe they break those are not supportive of me. Maybe it's because it's based on a Dat Yachid. See the greatness of Rabbi Yochanan over here? That even though he has Breitot that really seemingly support his position, he is intellectually honest to say that there's a possibility that these braitot are following a position that's not the halacha, and that's why these braitot believe that. They're holding like Beit Shammai. But if they held like Beit Hillel, they wouldn't say that, and they wouldn't have been supportive of me in that case. And therefore, I don't necessarily have braitot that support my position. Tanan hatam. Hamalveh et chavero ma'ot ala mashkon. So this goes back to what we mentioned earlier, that if you lend out money on a mashkon, on a piece of collateral, then it's not subject to Shemitah. You can see here, we're quoting the Mishnah in Shvi'it, the Mishnah Bet, which is the Mishnah before what we discussed yesterday, Mishnah Gimel, that deals with the Prusbol. This is the Mishnah before that. The Mishnah before that says, if you lend money on a Mashkon, v'moser shtarotav lebeitin, or you give over your shtarot to Beitin, ein mishamtim. They're not subject to Shemitah. This is what we discussed yesterday, v'moser shtarotav lebeitin, how is that different than Prusbol? Rashi says they are not. It's synonymous. That means that is the case of Prusbol. Tosafot said no, that this Maser Shtaratav, the Beit Din, works even midoraita. Even when Shemitah is doraita, it works. The Prusbol just institutionalized Maser Shtaratav, the Beit Din. That Hillel says that everybody should do this because it works, and we encourage people to do this so that we keep the liquidity in the market. But it would have worked even without the institution of Prusbol. So that's the machlok we saw between Rashi and Tosafot yesterday. So Gemara says, Bishlamo, Maser Shtaratav, the Beit Din. We understand why, when you give over your shtarot to Beit Din, that they're not subject to Shemitah. The tafsi lohu Beit Dinah, because the Beit Din is holding it on your behalf, as Rashi says over here. The hefkeran, hefker. Since Beit Din has a right of collection, but a right of collection in the sense that they can disown you from your property, so once you hand over to Beit Din, you basically, it's if collected. Because Beit Din is enough power to ensure that there will be collection over here, because even if the other person's refusing, Beit Din can just throw him out of his property and say, it's ours now, and we can have the payment made. And therefore, v'gabe milveh lo karinim be lo igos. There's no longer this problem of chasing down the borrower to get the money back. You don't have to chase anybody. Beit Din can just take action, unilateral action, and have the monies returned to the malveh. So because of that, it's considered as if collected, and we understand why Moser Shtarotav, the Beit Din, works. So that's how Rashi views it, working as Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker, very likely because Rashi sees it as being equivalent to Prusbol. As we saw with Prusbol before, the way that Prusbol worked was through Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker, at least according to Rova. Whereas other Rishonim view it that when you give over your Shtarot to Beit Din, it may be not because of Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker that it works, but rather, by giving it over to Beit Din, it's no longer subject to Lo Igos, which is that the borrower now is not going to go after the creditor, because it's with Beit Din, and Beit Din acting not as an individual, but as an institution, is not subject to Shemitah. And that might be what is the saving grace over here, which is that Beit Din is not governed by Shemitah, because they don't have the parameters that would make them subject to Shemitah Ksafim, and therefore, using the Prusbol, I'm being Moser Shtarotav, the Beit Din is what allows the individual to escape Shemitat Ksafim. Not like Rashi, which says Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker, but more in a generic sense that Beit Din is outside of that realm. But Ella, Malveh Ala Mashkon, person lends money with the collateral, my time. What's the reason over there that it works? So Amar Rova Mishum De Tofosle, because he is already holding the object. He doesn't have to pressure the borrower for the money. It basically, again, there's two mechanisms of payment. Those mechanisms of payment is either the borrower gives the money, or the creditor just keeps the collateral that's there. As far as keeping the collateral that's there, he doesn't have to go to the borrower at all. He simply has it in hand. He's basically paid back now. So since he's already holding the repayment of his loan, then it's not subject to Shemitah Ksafim, because he doesn't have to go after the borrower to get back his loan. So what happens if he lends him money and he lives in the chatzer that he's holding it already? So it's also over there, it's not mishamet. Now, what exactly the scenario here is not clear, but it seems to be, let's say they live in a similar chatzer. They live in a joint chatzer, whereby the malveh and the loveh both own a part of the chatzer. So over there, since the malveh lives in the chatzer, and he can readily take it because he lives in that chazer, then the Lovez property is as if collected for him because he literally lives there and has access to that property. That's one way to explain it. The other way to explain it is that he's actually renting the property from the Lovez. Since he's renting the property from the Lovez, he could just stop the rental payments and he can recoup his loan by simply abstaining from paying his rent. And so therefore it's as if collected. Or, again, that the fact that they live in a joint chatzer, and the loveh has property in the chatzer, meaning he has a stove, he has an oven, he has other things that are in the chatzer, that makes it that he has the easy ability to take whatever it is to get repayment of his loan or collateral. So that should be the case. Amalei, shani mashkon, dekoni lemi derabbi Yitzchak. A mashkon is different than chatzer, mean generic property, or the ability to withhold rent. All these other items are different than a mashkon. Mashkon has a unique standing, which is that the malveh, the creditor, owns the mashkon. So this goes back to your question from earlier. Wait, doesn't he have to give the mashkon back? Doesn't he have to give the item back? That is it. Amar Rav Yitzchak, minayin lebalchov shekoneh mashkon. How do you know that when it comes to a creditor that is holding collateral, a physical piece of collateral, here we're not talking about real property, we're talking about actual collateral, whether it's a piece of gold, a jewel, a pearl, whatever he's holding as collateral for the loan, then how do you know that he owns the collateral? Shnemar, ulecha tie tztaka. That it will be a tztaka for you, meaning that it will be a merit for you if you do this. Im enu koneh tztaka minayin. If he doesn't own it, then what type of tztaka is he giving over here? Mikan the bachov shekoneh mashkon. From here it's clear that the bachov owns the mashkon. This goes to your question, which is, he has to give the mashkon back. Every day, when he takes it from a poor individual, if he takes it something that he needs during the day, he takes the mashkon at night, gives it back to him during the day. He takes it something that he needs at night, he has to return it at night and take it back in the morning. The pasuk says there, ulechati etztaka. If you act in this manner, that'll be meritorious for you. Why is it meritorious for you? If it's his object, then of course you have to return it. What's the question of you having to return an object to someone that when it belongs to them? Ella, what does Rabbi Yitzchak say? It must belong to you. And the fact that it belongs to you and you still give it back each day or each night, depending on what the situation is, that is meritorious for you. So you see that whenever you're holding the collateral, it is yours. And you are doing tzedakah in the broader sense of charity by giving him back his object each day because it's really your object now. If that's the case, then when you lend out a mashkon, what we see here is the unique property of a mashkon is that the creditor owns the mashkon. The creditor owns the mashkon, then like I said before, the mechanism of payment are very easy. Either you show up with the money, or I already have collateral. I don't need you anymore. I don't need to go and collect from you. I have in hand basically the repayment of the loan. If that's the case, it's not subject to shmitat safim. Tosafot over here raises a serious issue with this, which is that Rabbi Yitzchak's din is only said about someone who takes collateral after the loan has been extended. Meaning that the person extended the loan, and then later goes, whether the person is defaulted now or is not repaying the loan, goes to take collateral, not at the initiation of the loan, but later on. And Rabbi Yitzchak says there that you own the mashkon, v'luchati etztaka. Rabbi Yitzchak is not dealing with a scenario in which the origins of the loan were done ala mashkon. Who says there that the din of Rabbi Yitzchak is applicable? Because Rabbi Yitzchak only spoke about a case where you take collateral in the middle of the loan, which seems to make more sense, because then when you take in the middle of the loan, you're basically taking in lieu of payment. Because the reason you go to take collateral when the loan's already extended is because the guy's not paying it back. Or you're really scared he's not paying it back, so you take this as payment. So over there it makes sense that you're really taking this in possession. When you take collateral at the origins of a loan, the reason you take collateral is because you just want to be secure about giving out the loan. You're not looking at this as the method of payment. You're still expecting to get paid back with cash. And so then maybe that's not the case. What Tosafot in the end ends up saying, and other Rishonim say the same thing, is that Rabbi Yitzchak's din of collateral in the middle of loan tells you something about collateral in general. And that even though maybe it's not exactly the same when the origins of the loan are with collateral, nevertheless, he says, Bishlamar de mistaver le shas, mechar de koni le mid Rabbi Yitzchak, shalo bishat havodo, olim nami shibudei bishat halva'a delo tishamet. That since when he takes collateral in the middle of the loan, Rabbi Yitzchak says you own the collateral, that gives you enough indication that a creditor's lock on collateral is strong enough that that has enough impact to stop Shemitat Safim. So even if it was done at the origins of the loan, that would still be sufficient grounds to not have Shemitat Safim affect this item. Right now, it's not Hotam. Rebbe Mishnah, again, in Shvi'it. HaMachzir Chov V'Chaveiro B'Shvi'it. Person who returns a loan during Shvi'it, Tzarich Shiyomar Lo Mishamet Ani. He has to say, I forgive the loan. So the borrower is coming to repay the creditor. The creditor has to say to the borrower, Mishamet Ani, it's forgiven. The loan is not outstanding anymore. And therefore, you do not have to repay it. This came back to the machloka that we saw yesterday between the Yireim and the Or Zeruah and many of the other Rishonim, which is that the Yireim believes that Hashmatat Ksafim only happens when the borrower says, Mishamet Ani. That he says the loan is forgiven. Until he says the loan is forgiven, then the loan is still outstanding. Whereas many of the other Rishonim said it was Afkata Demalko, that it's automatic. God makes it that the loan is automatically forgiven. His proof is from the fact here that the Malve has to say Mishametani. If it was really Afkata Demalko, why does he have to say Mishametani? He didn't have to say anything. He doesn't have to make any statement. It's done. The loan is forgiven. Why do we need the Malve to say it? Now the others argue that no, he says Mishametani because the borrower is trying to pay him back now. And so the Malva is telling him that you don't have to pay me back because the loan is not outstanding. By the way, one of the nafkaminot between these two items is what happens if the individual takes the repayment anyway. If he doesn't say Mishametani, he takes it. According to the Yireim, the loan is still outstanding because he doesn't say Mishametani. So even though he violates the Isur of Shemitah Safim, he's still taking money that really belongs to him because the loan is still outstanding. According to the other Rishonim, like the Or Zeruah, where the loan is Afgata Demalka, where the God basically forgave the loan, it doesn't exist anymore. If you take collection on that, you're stealing. It's not your money. And if you accept collection, then you're accepting collection for something that does not belong to you. That's one nafkamina. There are other nafkaminos that would come out from that different view as to whether the loan is really still outstanding or the loan is completely forgiven. That comes out of this Mishnah where he says Mishametani. Then, V'yama Marlo FLP came. If the lovet then says, the baru says, even so I want to repay it, yikabel amenu. Then the malveh is allowed to accept repayment, if the borrower wants to pay, despite the fact that he knows that it's been forgiven. Shenemar, b'zeh dvar ha-shmitah, because the requirement is dvar ha-shmitah. The Mishnah is darshing as dibur. That is, as long as you've said that the loan is forgiven, that's enough in terms of shmitat ksafim. You have to do more, no more than that, except to indicate that the loan is forgiven. If he still wants to pay it back afterwards as a quote-unquote matana, that's fine. You do not have to stop him from doing that. As long as you've clearly indicated through your articulation that it is a forgiven loan, after that, if he wants to pay back, that's fine, because you've accomplished dvar ha-shmita, that which was obligated or incumbent upon you, which is to tell him that the loan was forgiven. Then, Amar Rabo, now here it's a question about the girsa, whether it's Rabo or Rova, betali lei adamar hochi. Then, you can hang him up until he says that. Now, this is a very interesting and difficult statement by Rabo, which Rashi interprets very literally. What does betali lei? Rashi says, imaya rotze lach zorbo. If he wants to back out of paying back the loan, you're basically going to hang him up till he says, I'm going to pay it back. So that's very interesting. We just said now that you have to forgive the loan, or say mishametani. And then if the lova says, even so, I want to pay it back, you can accept it. What Rabo or Rova is indicating over here is that that's not really true. You don't have to just wait for the lova, but you can basically string him up and say, I'll wait for you to pay me back. Or you have this quote-unquote vigilante justice here where, okay, even though the loan's forgiven, I'm extrajudicial. I'm outside the courts. And since I'm outside the courts, I'll just tie you up until you're willing to pay me back. In a sense, that defeats the whole purpose of Shmitah Ksafim, because in the end, if you can squeeze it out of him, then what does Shmitah Ksafim mean if you can still pressure him to repay you? For that reason, many of the other Rishonim do not learn like Rashi, because of the implications of saying that you can basically squeeze the money out of him. If you look here, the Tosfot read, gives a little bit of a nuanced approach here. He says, Perush, b'dibar ba'alma shamar mishametani kiyema mitzvah. Once you say mishametani, you've already been making the mitzvah. V'achakach mutar legavot chovo. After that time, you're able to collect the loan. Not simply that you can accept the repayment. You can actually go and collect on the loan. Which again, conceptually means that what's the meaning of shmita ksafim? So here, the Tosafot read says here, Aval, im lo yiviam lo klau, if the lova never comes in front of you, eni ochola kofo, then you can't pressure him, shiviyem alav, to bring him to you, shari lo kiyem shum mitzvah, because he didn't do any mitzvah. So the Tosafot read qualifies Rashi's statement over here, which makes it a little more palatable, not easy, but a little more palatable, which is that the loan is forgiven, it's gone. If the lova does nothing at this point, the malva is not empowered to do anything. The malva can't act to go force the lova to repay it. He can do absolutely nothing. On the other hand, if the lova shows up in front of the malva to repay the money, then if the malva says mishametani, then he's done the mitzvah of saying that it's freed, then he can pressure the lova to pay back, because the lova took the initiative to show up in front of him. And so once he's taken that initiative to show up in front of you, and the malvez is mishametani, then he can go after him to collect his loan. And he can basically string him up till he gives the loan back. So by qualifying Rashi's statement a little bit, it makes it a little more palatable, which is that the Tosfot read says that it's only true where the lova took the initiative. The lova took the initiative, then the malvez is empowered to pressure him to give the money back once he's already said mishametani. On the other hand, if the lova takes no initiative, the malva has no rights here. He can't go after him because he never said mishametani, because the lova never volunteered to pay him back. And so what the read says is that the fact that the lova already volunteered to pay you back means that the lova really intended to start to give this gift back, or to give the money back. At that point, the malva, once he says mishametani, can basically compel him to go through with that action and to pay back the money. Other Rishonim learn it in a much simpler way, which is that the malva does not have to pretend that he doesn't want the money back. He can say, by the letter of the law, mishametani, that the loan is forgiven. But he can make indications afterwards like, I want the money back. He can basically say like this, I really want it. Meaning that he does not have to pretend that he doesn't want repayment of the loan. Even though by the letter of the law and by obligation he has to forgive the loan, he can still indicate to the lover that he'd much prefer if the lover paid it back. And that's what it means, talile. Talimi means that we do not stop him from making it clear to the lover that he would really appreciate if the lover paid it back. Now that has to do with something, a story that we see in Bechorot. With regards to Bechorot, it says over there by the Kohen, when the individual pays for the Pidyon Bechor, then he gives the money to the Kohen. The Kohen can then, after he gets the money, give it back to the individual who did the pidyon. That's the practice of Kohanim in general, is that once they take it, they then give it back to the original owner, and that they don't keep the money. There's a story there brought in Bechorot, whereby the individual gave the money to the Kohen, and then he stood around watching to see if he waiting for the Kohen to give it back. Over there, the Gemara says, he was not Yotzei Pidyon Bechor. Because over there, he gave the money, assuming he was going to get it back. He doesn't have a right to the money. There's no obligation on the Kohen to give the money back. And therefore, if you give it, assuming that you're going to get it back, then you really never gave it. If you give it, and then the Kohen voluntarily decides he wants to give it back, that's fine. But if you indicate you want it back, that means that you never gave it in a sense. That's what's being said here in the Gemara, according to these Rishonim, that it's okay for the Malvit to indicate he wants the money back. That's not a violation of Shmitat Kesafim. As long as he indicates that there's no obligation on the Lovet to give it back, and then he makes it clear that he'd like repayment of this money, and he would really like the money back, that is not problematic. And that's not a gam or a b'giah in his forgiveness of the loan. He can forgive the loan and say there's no obligation to pay it back, but I'd really like you to pay it back to me because I did lend you the money, I did you a favor, I'd really appreciate it if you paid it back. Again, the loan is under no obligation to do it, but the malveh can make it very clear that he would like the money paid back despite the fact that he's forgiven the loan. The Mishnah there says that the Ruach Chachamim Nochal Menu, that the Chachamim are very pleased with people who pay back despite Shmitat Kesafim, because the Chachamim are almost recognizing what Hillel said, that without Prusbol, and when there is real Shemitah Kesafim, if we're going to go through with it, if you want to keep the loan market open, then these borrowers need to know that if they pay back, they'll keep liquidity in the market. If they don't pay back, people are going to become more and more reluctant to loan out money, which is basically what Hillel realizes and has to institute Prusbol to get around that problem. But borrowers also have to be a party to the larger picture here and understand that if they do exercise this forgiveness of the loan and don't pay it back, that it will have impact in the long run on the ability to have people give out loans. So now, Gemara says, Eitve Abaye, Kishuno Teino, when he gives it to him, meaning the borrower gives the money back to the Malveh after Shmitat Kesafim, Al Yamar Lo Bichovi Ani Notein Lecha, don't say that I'm giving this back because of my obligation, and Al Yamar Lo Shelihein, that's my money, Umatana Ani Notein Lecha, and I'm giving them to you as a gift. So Abaye's challenge to Rabba or Rova over here is, you're saying that you can compel him to give the money back, whether according to Rashi, little means you can string him up. According to the other Rishonim, you can indicate that I really want it back. That implies that he thinks that you have a right of collection over here. Yet, the way that it is worded in the Mishnah is that when he gives it back, and basically makes a comment that it's voluntary. That I'm giving this back of my own volition, and that you have no rights to this money. The fact that I'm giving you the money is all a matana. So that does not sound like what is being indicated here, that you can be talile. So he says to him, Amarle, talile nami adamar hochi. No problem. You can tie him up according to Rashi until he says that. Like the equivalent of Amar Rotsani. So you want him to say that? He'll say that. You tie him up until he says, I'm ready to give you a gift. The language that he has to use here, we'll make sure that that's the language that he uses. Again, according to Rashi, it's a very difficult scenario because you're compelling him and having him say, oh, I want to give you a gift. Of course he wants to give you a gift. You're hanging him up on a tree. Of course he wants to give you a gift. According to the other Rishonim, it's just the fact that you're indicating you want it back, but in the end, when he gives it back, it's still a matana. Even though you're indicating you want repayment, you're not taking a repayment. You're basically saying to him, I'd really like the gift. Instead of indicating to him, I'd really like repayment of the loan, you're basically saying, I really would like the gift back because it would be a nice thing for you to do. Abba Bar Marta, Dehu Abba Bar Menyume. So Abba Bar Marta, who is also known as Abba Bar Menyume, have a Mesik Bei Rabba Zuze. Rabba was a creditor to him. Aitinu Niale Bishvi'it. He brought them to him on the Shvi'it. Amalei Mishamet Ani. He says, I forgive the loan. You do not have to pay them back. So now, this is interesting. This is very supportive of the Sheet of the Rosh, that Shmitat Safim really starts at the beginning of the Shmita year. And only is the actual forgiveness of the loan only happens at the end of the Shmita year. But during the Shmita year, you don't have a right of collection. That's exactly what this sounds like. This sounds like he came during the Shmita year to Rabbah, and he says to him, Mishametani. Why is he saying Mishametani if he's coming during Shvi'it? Shmita Kesafim doesn't take place until Miket Shevashanim, at the end of the seventh year. So you can see in Rashi says Bishvi'it is not literally in Shvi'it, like we said before, Machzir Chol V'Chavero Bishvi'it. Doesn't literally mean on Shvi'it, but rather, Bizman Sheshvi'it Noheget. Bishvi'it doesn't mean on Shvi'it literally, but it means at the time that Shvi'it is practiced, because then there is Shmita Kesafim. So Rashi and the other Rishonim read it differently, that B'Shvi'it doesn't mean on Shvi'it the year itself, but at a time when Shvi'it was practiced, and therefore they were subject to Shmitat Ksafim. Which is interesting, because we're talking about Amoraim like Rabbo, who, again, their situation is no different than our situation today. When you talk about a Bishvi'it in the Mishnah, then you can talk about it being different than our times now, because the Mishnah is written prior, or could have been written before the Churban HaBayit. On the other hand here, when you're talking about Rabbo, who says Bishvi'it, it's harder to read it that way. But again, that's how the Rishonim read it, so that it doesn't support necessarily this Shita of the Rosh. So I'm like, Mishameitani, I forgive it. Shaklinu Vazal, he took his money and went home. He said, all right, the loan's forgiven. I don't have to repay it. No problem, I'm taking my money with me. So then, Ata Abaye Ashkechei Davi Otsif. Abaye came to see whether it's his Rebbe Rabbo. He finds him that he is saddened by this. Amalei, Amai Otsif Mar. He says, what are you so upset about? What are you so despondent about? Amalei, Ochi Avamase. He tells him over the story about this Abba Bamarta that brought the money. Rabbi forgave the loan, and the guy walked out with the money. So Azel Legabei, Abaye goes to Abba Bamarta, Amalei. Amatat Lezuze, the Mar. He says, did you bring money to repay Mar? Mar being his Rebbe, Rabbo. Amalei, in. Amalei, Umayar Malucha. So he said, what did he respond to you? He says, Amalei, Mishamitani. He says, it's forgiven, the loan's out. Amalei, Vamartle Afopikain. Did you say to him afterwards, even so, I want to repay it? Amalei, lo. Said, I didn't say that. Amalei, Vi Amartle Afopikain, have a shaklinu minach. Do you know that if had you said that, Rabba would have taken the money? Had you said Afopikain, Rabba would have accepted the money at that point. Hashta, Miat, Amtinu Nihalei. So he says, listen, go give him the money. Ve'emalei afo pikein. And say, despite the fact that the loan's forgiven, that I'm ready to repay it. Azo amtinu ni'alei. Abba Bamarta goes with the money back to Rabba. Va'amalei. And he said to him, afo pikein. Shaklinu minei. Rabba took the repayment of the money. Just like what the Mishnah says. Amar lohava be data by tsubrim derabbana mi'ikara. He says that this young Talmud Chacham, this Abba Bamarta, didn't really know the halacha originally. Because Abaye had to inform him that what he should have done after Rabba said Mishamitani is Afal Pikain. Now whether this is Rabba the Shitato, where you can quote unquote pressure the Loved to give the money back, basically what happened here is Abaye comes back to Loved and says you should pay it back anyway. Despite the fact that it's forgiven, you should be paying it back. And not in a pressure like hanging him up on a tree, but pressure in the sense that Abaye goes and tells him, you know that the proper way to act in this case is to give the money back. So in a sense, you're compelling him to give a matana back to the lender. Either he's acting on his own shita, or if it's Rava's shita, then he's basically acting in concert with the Mishnah, which says that even when you've forgiven the loan, the borrower should make an effort to repay despite the fact that the loan was forgiven. And that's what's being carried out over here. I'm Rav Yehuda, Rav Nachman. Neman adam lomar, pruzbol haya biyadi, vavad mimeni. The individual can say that I did have a pruzbol, but I lost it. It's a my time, huh? Came into the Kinu Rabbanim Pruzbol, because there's an institution of Pruzbol, Lo Shavik Hetera Bachali Sura. A person's not going to take the option or the route by which he has to collect Be'isura, where they can collect Be'heter. Yeah, a person now knows that Shemitah's coming, and Shemitah's gonna forgive the loans. So he has two choices now. He has a choice to put a Pruzbol in place, and basically protect his loans in a manner of Heter. Or, he can basically say afterwards, go and collect it, even without a pruzbol, or basically violate the halacha. People, when it doesn't take too much effort, will always choose the root of heter versus the root of isur. So therefore, if someone comes along to you and says, I want to collect the loan, and I had a pruzbol, the likelihood is that they did put a pruzbol in place, because it doesn't take much to put a pruzbol in place. And if you put a pruzbol in place, you can collect now without violating any isurim. So we're going to believe that people make that little effort to ensure that they do a bad teira and not be isura. So we believe him when he says that he lost his pruzbol. And Rabbeinu Tam notes over here that that's afilu below shvua. That he's neman, even if he doesn't take a shvua, he's neman over here. Many other Rishonim disagree with that and say that he's neman with a shvua, but not neman without a shvua. Ki'atu lekamei derav. When people used to come before Rav, amalei midei pruzbol ayalocha vavad. Maybe you had a pruzbol and it was lost. So here the Gemara comments on that. Gonzeb tach pichol ilemho. Over here, that's like leading the witness. He says it's one thing if the litigant comes and says I had a pruzbol and it was lost. It's another thing for the court to suggest maybe you had a principle and it got lost. So Rav takes an active role in suggesting that to the individual. By doing that, of course he realizes that that's a good claim. And then how can we say that he's Neman now? Because the court already led him down a path which he's going to say that. Now Rav obviously believes that the person might not think that he has the ability to make such a claim that the principle was lost. Or he might have forgotten that he had a prusbol, and there is a value in reminding him about this issue of prusbol. But the Gemara thinks that that is too far, because that's already leading him down a path of a claim that he might not have made otherwise. Tanan, v'chein b'chov, shemotzi shtar chov, ve'enimo prusbol. A creditor takes out a document of credit, and it does not have a prusbol with it. Her'elu lo yifru'u, you don't have to pay. So here you see pretty clearly that if a person takes out a document that says that he lent money, he doesn't have a prusbol with it, we don't automatically assume that he did have a prusbol, and he can collect the money. The Braita says, you can't collect the money. Tanaehi, that is a machloket tanaim, meaning that there are tanaim that argue about whether we allow the person to be believed when he says the prusbol was lost, or we don't. Meaning that, do we assume that, or we don't assume that? Tanya, motzi shtar chov, tzerech sheyeh mo prusbol. That a person takes out a shtar chov, has to have a prusbol with it in order to collect. Chamim armim, eino tzerech. Meme say he doesn't have the prusbol on hand. If he says, I had a prusbol, that's enough. He doesn't have to physically have the prusbol with him. So you see here that's a machloket tanaim as to whether the person is believed when he says that he had a prusbol. Here the chachamim have the position that he is believed, which would seem to indicate that we would paskin that way, that if he said, I had a prusbol, even though he can't show us documentation of the prusbol, we would believe him. Okay, next Mishnah. Now again, as we know here, the Mishnayot and the Perek now are talking about Tikkun Olam. So here again, we're going to bump into something that is Tikkun Olam, which is Eved Shinishba. You have an Eved Knani that was taken into captivity. Uptahu, and they redeemed him. Im Lishum Eved, if he's redeemed to remain an Eved Knani, Yishtabed, then he will remain that way. Im Lishum Ben Chorin, if he was redeemed to be a free man, Lo Yishtabed, then he will be a free man. Shimon Gamliel Omer, Ben Kach Yishtabed. Doesn't matter why he was redeemed, whether he's redeemed to go free or redeemed to be an Eved, he will remain an Eved. Now the Gemara is going to explain this. But Maya Skinan, what exactly is the case over here? It's clear that Eved Kanani belongs to a master. The fact that he's an Eved Kanani by definition means that he has a master, and now he ends up in captivity. What does his master think of him right now, or what is his master's relationship with him? Ilei malifnei yeush, if the master has not given up hope of his return, then the Shum ben Chorin amai lo yishtabed. Then even if you redeem him to be a free person, why shouldn't he be subject to being an Eved Knani or continuing to be Eved Knani? Because he's owned by his original owner, and you can't separate the original owner from the Eved Knani because it's his property. Why are you allowed to take away the property of the original owner? Ela lachar yeush. It must be after the original owner gave up hope of getting this Eved back. It means that he's basically relinquished control or ownership over the Eved Kanani. The Shum Eved, am I Yishtabed? Then if the person redeems him to be an Eved, then why should he have to be an Eved Kanani? The owner had no hope of getting him back, then why should he have to be an Eved Kanani? So I'm Rabbi Elolam Lefei Yeush. It was before Yeush. Meaning here, these marauders, or whoever they are, came into the city, took this Eved Kanani captive from his owner, and now we're going to redeem him. Meaning they're paying the ransom to get him back. And therefore, the Shum Eved Yishtabed L'Rabbo Arishon. If he's redeemed to remain as an Eved Kanani, he goes back to his original owner, because it was before Yeush. The Shum Ben Chorim Lo Yishtabed Lo L'Rabbo Arishon V'Lo L'Rabbo Asheni. If he is redeemed to be a free man, then he's not put into slavery, not to his original owner, and not to the Rabbo Asheni. Rabbo Asheni is the person who's redeeming him here, the one who's paying the ransom. The Rabbo Asheni Lo, to the second one, the one who's ransomed low, da'al l'shum ben chorim parke, because he redeemed him to be a free man. So what would be any reason that you would enslave him to the second owner? The rabo shon nami lo dimuna mimne velo pirke. Because if we don't allow this to happen, then maybe people will not redeem the Eved Kanani. Meaning that if you tell the second guy when he redeems it, he's going to go back to his original owner, then the guy will say, why am I bothering to ransom him out to get this guy his Eved Kanani back? Now the truth is, that maybe there is a mitzvah to redeem him anyway, which we're going to see in a second. Either way, he should go back to being a slave to his original owner. Kasavar, kashem shem mitzvah liftotet bnei chorim, kav mitzvah liftotet avadim. that just like there's a mitzvah to redeem free people, ransom them, so too there is to ransom an Eved Kenani. There's no difference in the level of the mitzvah. An Eved Kenani is chayav in mitzvot ki'isha. He has a status of a full-fledged Jew with regards to this, and therefore ransoming him is no different a mitzvah, or no less a mitzvah than ransoming a regular Jew from captivity. If that's the case, you don't have to give the person who's doing this, the redeemer, any incentive. He's doing a mitzvah either way. And if he goes back to being enslaved to his first master, it doesn't matter. So that's the way that it's explained. Now, do the Chachamim disagree with that? Chachamim can argue on that on two levels. They can either say that's not true, that there's a greater mitzvah to redeem a Ben Chorim than there is to redeem an Eved Kenani. Even though there's still a mitzvah to do it, the mitzvah is still greater for a Ben Chorim. And so what the Chachamim wanted to do was allow the Eved Kenani to be redeemed despite the fact that it's a lesser mitzvah by saying that if you redeem him as a free man, then he will go free because then he'll become a full-fledged Jew if he's redeemed to be a free man. When an Eved Kenani is freed, he becomes a, finishes off his conversion process basically and becomes a full-fledged Jew, so people will do it in that way or will be encouraged to do it. Or they could fundamentally agree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel that they're equal. It's just in people's perception, they will redeem a free person and not an Eved Kenani because they think there is a difference. And so in order to dispel that mistaken impression, they allow the Eved Kenani to go free once he's redeemed because of the necessity to have people redeem these Avadim Kenaniim. So that encouragement is done by making them into free people or making it that they become a full-fledged Jew when they are returned, if that's what he redeems him or how he ransoms him.
The Gemara says, Rav Amar, Dolam Lachar Yeush.
The case here is actually after Yeush. In that the first one is giving up hope, the first owner is giving up hope of getting him back.
L'shum Eved Yishtabed the Rabo Sheni.
So when he redeems him for an Eved, that means that the second person, the one who redeems him, gets him as an Eved Kenani. Because now it's the equivalent of purchasing him as an Eved Kenani.
L'shum Ben Chorin Lo Yishtabed, if he redeems him as a free man, not. Lo the Rabo Shom, Lo the Rabo Sheni.
Not to the first guy, not to the second.
The Rabo Sheni Lo, Dalashum Ben Chorin Pirkei.
Because he redeemed him to be a free man. What's the reason to make him into a slave to the second guy?
The Rabo Rishon Nami Lo, Dalachar Yeush Abba.
The first guy doesn't get him back because he's already had a Yeush. He doesn't have any ownership left in this Eved, and therefore if you redeem him, he goes free.
Shimon Gamaliel Omer Ben Kach Ben Kach Yishtabed Kedechizkia.
He remains a slave either way because of Chizkia.
Damar Chizkia Mipnei Mamru Ben Kach Ben Kach Yishtabed.
Why do we say either way that he goes back to being in Shibud? This is a great way for a slave to get out of his problems. What is he going to do? He realizes as long as he's under this owner's ownership, nothing's going to happen. He has no future. So what he's going to do, he's going to basically throw himself into a position where he's going to be taken into captivity. Now once he's taken into captivity, someone will ransom him out. When they ransom him out, he'll go free. So for that reason, we don't want him to go free because otherwise it's an incentive for him to throw himself into captivity to get himself out of the auspices of this owner.
Ben Kach Ben Kach Yishtabed, it's not clear here from Shimon Gamliel under whose auspices he goes.
Meaning that when the second guy redeems him after Yeush, and then he goes into Shibud, whose Shibud does he go into? When we say when he redeems him as a free man, he goes into Shibud. Is that the Shibud to the Sheni that redeemed him? Was that Shibud to the first one, even though it's Achar Yeush, because of this Gzeirah? It's not clear here. The Rishonim argue about which one he goes back to. Some of them argue that going to the Sheni would also be problematic because then you wouldn't disincentivize him because he might think that I'll have a better life under somebody else. Even if he will remain an Eved Kenani, he wants to get out of this owner. He doesn't like this owner and he wants to get away. So he'll run away and then someone else will buy him and be under a different ownership. So therefore, in order to prevent or disincentivize him, you have to send him back to his original owner. That's some Rishonim. Other Rishonim say it's Achar Yeush. If it's Achar Yeush, then it goes to the second one. So that's what you see in Tosafot. Ben Kach Ben Kach Yishtabed to Kechizkia, Perish Bekunshis, the Rabbi Arishon. That's what Rashi says. He goes back to the original owner. V'chein Megia Rabbeinu Tam. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says as well. Although you can see, or you know, that there are other Rishonim who are going to argue on this point and say that he goes to Rabbi Sheni, who paid for him. All right, Meitavei. Amar Lehen Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's response to the Chachamim is, K'shem Shemitzvah Liftotet B'nei Charim, Kach Mitzvah Liftotet Abadim. Just like there's a mitzvah to redeem free people, there's also a mitzvah to pay ransom for Avadim Kenaniim. According to Abaye's explanation, Damar Lifneyush, Hainu Dekamar Kishem. That is what it meant here. That's exactly why he believes the Chachamim are wrong.
is because we don't worry about this preference for redeeming free people versus Avdei Kenanim, because they're an equal mitzvah. And so then his statement, Rabbi Shmuel's statement in explaining his position makes sense. Ela Larova Damar Lachar Yehush, who says the case is after Yehusha, Hai Kashem, Mishum Chizkiyahu do. What do you mean, Kashem? That's not the reason Rabbi Shmuel says that he goes back into Shibud. The reason he goes back into Shibud is because of Chizkiyah. He's giving the wrong reason for his position. So Amalacha Rova, Shimon Gamliel, Lovi Yoda, my Kamri Rabbanon. Shimon Gamliel didn't know what exactly was the position of the Rabbanon. Vachi Kamar Luhu, and this is what he meant to say to them. I, Lifne Yehush Kamri Tu, if he was before Yehush, Hainu Kashem. Then he's responding like Abai would have him respond. Ila Achar Yehush Kamri Tu, Kedi Chizkiyah. And if it's after Yehush, then the answer is like Chizkiyah. So, again, still you have to add question, why is it that he says Kashem? Meaning that if it's Lachar Yehush, then if that's the main reason or the main way that he should read it, then why isn't he giving the reason? What you have to say here is the Chachamim don't give a reason for their position, and therefore Chizkiyah is not on any obligation to give a reason. And so there he says Chizkiyah, and therefore that's it. And by the way, Chizkiyah is, or whether you can say Kashem, is a Tikkun Olam issue here. All of these issues are Mipnei Tikkun Olam, and that's why it's found here, so that people should redeem the slave. The Tikkun Olam, according to Abaye, is that we want to encourage people to redeem them. The Tikkun Olam, according to Rava, is that the slaves shouldn't run away and throw themselves into captivity. But either way, there is a Tikkun Olam. So what you have to say here is that if it was La'achar Yehush, then the answer is obvious, because of the Chizkiyah, and he doesn't have to give a reason, because the Chachamim didn't give a reason. But if it's Lifnei Yehush, which would make it that it's a different case and not maybe exactly what the Chachamim are talking about, he says, even if it's before Yehush, I still disagree with you because of Kashem. And that's why he only brought that reason and not the reason of Chizkiyah. If it's going to Rava that it's after Yehush, and then he goes to the second master, at least in the case where he redeems him to be an Eved. So now when he redeems him to be an Eved, he goes to the second master, meaning the person who redeemed him, he becomes an Eved Kenani. So then, Rabo Sheni Miman Konile. Who is he acquiring him from? Meaning that if you buy somebody, or you take ownership, you can only buy from something that somebody owns. Do the captors own this Eved Kenani that they can sell it to him? Mi Shavai. He's buying them from the captors. Shavai gufei mi konile. The captors, who did they take it from? Who do they have the ownership from? In konile the masei yadav. They do have acquisition or control over him from his masei yadayim. So now what you have here is the original owner has given up hope of getting him back. So basically this Eved Kenani became hefker. He was not owned by anybody. Once he's not owned by anybody, then the captors are the ones that are holding him right now. So they become the effective owners of this Eved Kenani. The only problem is that a Kenani cannot own an Eved Kenani. They don't have the ability to buy him for his goof. An Eved Kenani in the Halacha or in the Torah has a kinyan a goof, meaning that the Yisrael owns him like property. He owns him entirely, and he can give him over as a Yerusha to his children. He has full ownership in the individual. As far as an Eved Ivri is concerned, Yisrael only has a leasehold on him. He has the right to his output. He doesn't have a kinyan a goof in the Eved Ivri. The same is true for a relationship between, like, Yisrael to Yisrael. So too, the same is true of a Kenani to a Kenani. He can only own his Masei Yadayim. And so what's happening here is, when the original owner gives up control, where he really owned him fully, Kinyan Aguf, then he becomes Hefker. The captors then take possession of him. They can only take possession of him for his Masei Yadayim, or for his output. That means that when the Rabo Sheni comes to redeem him, ransoms him, the only thing that he can buy him for is his Masei Yadayim. He can only buy what the original owner has. The original owner here are the captors. They own a leasehold in his output. So then when he buys him, all he can get from him is a leasehold in his output. So that's what it means here. In Koni Le Masei Yadav, Damar Ish Lakish, Minayin Ovid Kochavim Shekanayet Ovid Kochavim Masei Yadav. How do we know that if an Ovid Kochavim buys another Ovid Kochavim to be an Eved, quote unquote, or for his Masei Yadayim, for his output, that it works? Shenemar. So amongst those gerim that live with you, from them you can buy. Atem konim mehem, v'lohem konim mikem. You can buy them as property. They cannot buy you as property. I mean, they can't buy you, but they can only buy you for the masei yadayim. V'lohem konim zeh mizeh. And they can't buy from each other. Yachol lo yiknu zeh zeh. Yachol lo yiknu zeh zeh. Yochel, no, it's, how could you ask a question like that? What do you mean, yochel, that they can't be koneh? Hamart, hello, came konim, zemizeh, that they are not allowed to acquire from each other. What do you mean? Maybe they can't buy from each other. The Braita explicitly says they can't buy from each other. Now, hafi gamar, vloim konim zemizeh legufo. They can't purchase each other to have a full ownership, like a property, like ownership in each other. You would think that maybe they can't buy each other for their leasehold or for their output. Amar, it's kal v'chomer. It's a kal v'chomer. Ovei kochavim Yisrael koneh. Ovei kochavim buying a Yisrael that he can have a leasehold in him. Ovei kochavim lo kol shekein. Certainly, if an Oved Kochavim buying a Yisrael, then an Oved Kochavim should be able to buy an Oved Kochavim. Ve'ema, hanimile bekaspa. Maybe that only works through monetary transactions, meaning that there are different ways to be koneh. Kinyan works for property with kesef, shtar, and chazakah. That's only true by Jews. Jews use the kinyanim of kesef, shtar, and chazakah by real property. So their ability to be koneh and eved kanani can be through kesef, shtar, and chazakah. But for a non-Jew where his only vehicle of kinyan is kaspa, is money, maybe it should only be true here that kaspa works, meaning that same animili be kaspa of chazak alone. Maybe it's true, just like the Jew can acquire through kesef the eved kanani, so too the non-Jew can only acquire an eved kanani through kesef. But chazakah would not work, and that's a problem here. Because the captors who took him only have ownership over him because of chazakah, not because of kesef. They didn't pay anything for this eved kanani. They stole him. They captured him. So their only ownership is through chazakah. So Amar Papa, Amon Uma'av Tiaru B'Sichon. Ashkachan Oved Kochavim Yisrael Minolon. So now we see that an Oved Kochavim can buy another Oved Kochavim, at least for Kinyan Masei Yadayim, and that's whether with kesef or chazakah. How do we know that Oved Kochavim can buy Yisrael? Through Kesef, we know he has a Kenyan like that. How do we know that Oved Kochavim can buy Yisrael through Chazakah? Dichtev, Vayish Bimenu Shevi. Because it says there that the Knanim took captives from Bnei Yisrael. And the fact that they're called Shevi, that they're called captives, shows you that the Chazakah works to gain them ownership in these individuals. What the Gemara says over here is that Bnei Yisrael are restricted from waging battle against Ammon and Moab. Al Titzureim, Al Tetzar Behem. You're not allowed to wage battle. You're not to start off with Ammon and Moab. Yet, what we find over here is that Bnei Yisrael conquered areas that seemingly belong to Ammon and Moab. How did they do that? And we even see that later on in the time of Yiftach, when he sends messengers to them to say, why are you trying to battle with us? Why are you fighting with us? They basically say, you stole property from us. In the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, you stole what belonged to us. But what do we know here? And Yiftach answers them that we conquered that which was belonged to us. Why? Because Sichon, we saw there, took over those areas that once belonged to Moab. That's what it says in the Pasuk. This Pasuk says, Vayirash et arzo mi'arnon ad Yabok. When Bnei Yisrael conquered Eretz Sichon, the area was from Arnon until Yabok. These were areas that were formerly belonging to Ammon and Moab, and Sichon conquered them. By Sichon's conquering of them, he was, quote-unquote, mitaher them. It made it permissible for Bnei Yisrael to then attack and conquer those lands, because they are under the auspices of Sichon, not under the auspices of Ammon and Moab, who they are restricted from fighting with or taking their property. What do you see from this? That how did Sichon gain ownership over that property? He didn't buy it from Ammon and Moab. He simply took it over. He conquered it. So his conquest established a chazakah on that area. So you see from that, that Ovdei Kochavim have the ability to acquire through chazakah. Because Sichon took acquisition of the properties of Ammon and Moab through conquest. And then Bnei Yisrael conquered those properties and they were not restricted by the restrictions of attacking Ammon and Moab. That means that Sichon took possession of that through chazakah. That proves you that Oved Kochavim can take possession through kesef, or he can take possession through chazakah. And that's why the captors over here have possession over this Eved Kanani through chazakah. Now chazakah, when we speak about an Eved Kanani, is not chazakah like property. Chazakah by an Eved Kanani is that you treat him like an Eved Kanani. He ties your shoes, he takes you to the bathhouse, he does things that make it look like he is servicing you or acting like an Eved Kanani to you. That's what chazakah means. Tosafot disagrees with Rashi's view of chazakah here, that chazakah means that you treat him like an Eved Kanani. but rather he says that chazaka over here means like a more classic sense of chazaka, which is kibush milchama. That the chazaka here means through conquest that you can create a chazaka. And he says that's what is meant here when Ammon and Moab were taken by Sichon. Just like they took the land through chazaka, through conquest, they also take possession of them, of the individuals, through a chazaka, that they can take possession of their guf. The Reed says over here, aval b'chazaka, she goes low b'koach mi'chaveiro, that they, according to the Reed, then the chazaka over here is stealing the individuals, capturing them, taking them away. Here you have different views as to what exactly the chazaka is meant by over here. As Tosfot notes over here, that goyim have other kinyanim besides kinyan kesef. They have kinyan meshicha. And what the question of the Gemara here is not, does kinyan chazaka work at all, but rather, a kinyan chazaka of kibush, is that a valid form of chazaka? Is that a valid form of taking ownership? Now the Gemara says, how do you know that Ovi Kuchavim also has the ability to take possession of a Jew through chazaka? That's from the pasuk of Yishbay Menu Shevi, that is brought in Parshat Chukat, when the Kananim attack Bnei Israel and they take a captive from Bnei Israel. The fact that it calls them a Shevi, meaning that they are captives, that means that they have taken possession of the individual to make them into a captive. And that shows you that Ovi Kuchavim has an ability to take possession of Israel through chazaka as well. And that is now what we have are Ovi Kuchavim can purchase another Ovi Kuchavim through Kesef or chazaka, and it can have a leasehold in that individual. The same is true of an Ovi Kuchavim buying a Israel, that he can have a leasehold in him, and he can acquire him both through Kesef and chazaka. For Israel, he can buy an Eved Kanani for either Masei Yadav as a leasehold, or he can buy him for his goof. Depends how he's sold. If he's sold by another Ovi Kuchavim, then unless he's already an Eved Kanani, it doesn't help, because the ownership of the Ovi Kuchavim is only a Masei Yadayim. So he can, what he owns, he can sell to you. So he can sell to you the Masei Yadayim. If the Eved Kanani voluntarily sells himself into slavery, then you can buy him for gufo, you can buy him for his full ownership, and then you can have full rights inside of the individual. So that's what's being said over here. When the Rabbo Rishon has Yeush, gives up hope of getting him back, he's relinquished all ownership. That means that the captors have now taken ownership over him through chazaka, by holding him in captivity. So now what? They're an Ovid Kochavim to Ovid Kochavim. That means that they own him for his Masei Yadayim. When the Rabbo Sheni comes and redeems him, ransoms him, he can only purchase from the captors what the captors own. They own him for his Masei Yadayim. He will purchase him for his Masei Yadayim. And that's how the Rabbo Sheni will take possession of this individual, by buying him for his Masei Yadayim, but not for his goof. Okay, we're going to stop here. 10 lines down on the top of Lamed Chet Amud Aleph.